Welcome back, everyone. We're coming up to our third and final panel of the day. I'd like to remind you that if you do have questions, to write them down. And as you write them down, if you can hold your hand up then and get them brought up, that helps us think about the question and whether we can actually ask it or not. I'd like to introduce now the moderator of our final panel, Deborah Leckman. Deborah is a commissioner at the OSC, and she is chair of the Human Resources and Compensation Committee of the Commission. Deborah will take over now. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our next panel will discuss enhancements to disclosure and choice for investors. The panelists for this discussion are Paul Bourque, President and CEO of the Investment Funds Institute of Canada, Dwayne Green, President and CEO at Franklin Templeton Investments Canada, Dan Howlett, Vice President and Principal Highview Financial Group, and Sandra Kagi, Executive Director, Federation of Mutual Fund Dealers. But first, I'll turn to Chantal to introduce the discussion.
The last two discussions primarily focused on the impacts resulting from structural changes to dealer compensation payment models to address the market efficiency and investor protection issues the CSA identified in the paper, and in particular, the conflict of interest that arises with the use of embedded commissions. However, there are other important issues created by embedded commissions that flow from the inherent conflicts of interest in this type of payment model. Specifically, we are concerned that embedded commissions, due to their embedded nature and complexity, inhibit the ability of investors to assess, understand, and manage the impact of dealer compensation on their investment returns. We're also concerned that embedded commissions cause investors to pay indirectly through fund management fees, dealer compensation that may not reflect the level of advice and service that investors may actually receive. That is, the cost of advice and service provided may exceed its benefit to investors. So this discussion will focus on other alternative solutions that have been presented by industry stakeholders that are mainly geared towards increasing investor awareness and understanding of fund fees, as well as improving the alignment of services received in exchange for the compensation paid. Specifically, we want to focus on how these proposed alternatives can impact the behavior of dealers and representatives and investors, independent from any structural changes to embedded commissions, such as a cap on trailing commissions or the discontinuation of the DSC option. I'll now turn it over to Commissioner Leckman to ask questions of our panelists and moderate the discussion.
Thank you, Chantal. Our first question focuses on service level agreements. One alternative option consistently presented to the CSA is to require dealers to provide their clients a minimum level of service in exchange for compensation through embedded commissions, for example, through a service level agreement. While conceptually this could be a positive result for investors, we are concerned with how this type of agreement may be used in practice. For example, today, at the outset of an investor-advisor relationship, clients are provided a host of account opening documents and disclosure that can be overwhelming. Buried within these documents is disclosure that commonly limits a firm's liability and explains what the client will not receive. Please, therefore, discuss how this type of agreement will lead to a different result. Specifically, we would like to understand how this can be used to ensure that an investor will receive the optimal services they want at the price they are willing to pay, and how those services will be aligned with the compensation they pay their dealer. We'll start with Paul.
Thanks very much, Commissioner Leckman, and thank the OSC for hosting this roundtable. As I chatted with an old friend, he suggested that I summarize the IFIC position, because he mentioned to me that not everybody would have read our submission. And given its length, I'm sure that's quite true, but it does relate back to your question. And So when we reviewed the CSA paper, it was very clear, and the paper made it very clear what the concerns were. And they're all legitimate concerns, and they're all concerns worthy of regulatory attention. What we thought about conflict of interest in particular was that a ban on embedded commissions wouldn't solve the problem of conflicted compensation, and we were concerned that it was disproportionate. The benefits were well articulated, but the costs not so well quantified. And so we thought, what could we do to address the overall question? We thought it would be very worthwhile to propose an alternative. And the topic under discussion right now was one of the things we had proposed, none of which, either individually or in their aggregate, would address all of the concerns around the conflict and the harm that's in embedded commissions. Only a ban would do that. But we thought we could address enough of the concerns that it would provide an alternative to moving to a regulatory solution that we thought was disproportionate and would have been very disruptive. In terms of why this might be a good thing for investors, clearly investor behavior can be impacted by disclosure. And disclosure doesn't always work. A lot depends on how it's framed, the timing. And there's lots of good research on when disclosure will work and when it won't work. So we're really in favor of a solution that would focus on regulatory measures that promoted disclosure as a solution here, putting in, making it transparent to the investor what they're paying for when they're paying a trailer fee. It simply allows the investor to understand and to assess the value. And is the value worth it to me or not? And should I be paying this fee or not? So then an investor can make a decision. Trailer fees today, and IFIC has a position on trailer fees, and we've set out what we think they what they should be for. And there's really four things. Trading and access to capital markets is part of the trader fee. Account support, account opening and closing, account statements and confirms, advisor overhead, reporting to clients, most of which is found in 31103, Part 14, Division 5. It sets out all of those things that have to be reported. Supervision, compliance, and investor recourse, things like OBC and SIPF and investor remedies. And finally, advice, assisting investors determining financial goals, risk tolerance, recommendations, portfolio construction, ongoing review, and rebalancing. And we think all those things should be set out for investors on their merits and allow investors to make an informed decision about the product they want to buy and the way they want to pay for it.
Anyone else like to add their comments?
I'd be happy to mention something about service agreements. Can I get on with that? But before I do that, I just have one little thing to say about deferred sales charges. Because now I'm up here, you can't say no. I just want to remind everybody that over the last at least 10 years, where there's been a market decline, mutual funds have been the investments that have been touted as buoying a slumping market. It's because of DSC, because of the buy and hold nature of that product, how that product started and how it is still sold today. That's what kept the markets going over the years. I just wanted to remind people about that. They have served a very, very important purpose. And the other thing I want you to know, sitting up here with no skirt on the table, it's really hard to keep your legs at the same angle for a whole hour. So if you want to know what I'm really thinking about through this whole thing, it's just keep your legs where they are. Okay. A service agreement might eliminate trailers paid to discount brokers, which we would think is a good thing. But in the mutual fund dealer channel, independent from any structural changes to the existing compensation models, the Federation is not in favor of a service level agreement. We believe that service agreements would unnecessarily increase the regulatory burden, which was mentioned earlier. With the addition of prescriptive rules and oversight, additional supervisory controls, and amended policies and procedures, all with little or no corresponding value, especially when you add this to existing account opening, pre-trade, post-trade, quarterly and annual disclosures, including the annual report on fees and compensation. And we agree that while disclosure requirements are what they are at the moment, this would get buried in the plethora of incomprehensible account opening documents clients receive. That said, should the CSA, for example, determine to eliminate trailer fees and all embedded commissions for a full fee-for-service remuneration model, I would expect that a menu of potential services would be articulated for the client to choose from. One section would be devoted to what information and service is provided that is mandatory, i.e., due to securities regulation, with a corresponding fee. And the list would move on from there to items that the dealer and or advisor would or could offer with corresponding fees. However, given the opportunity to build their own customized bundle of services, many of our research participants did not choose the things that behavioral research shows are key to achieving long-term investing decisions. And just because I will refer to it again, the Federation commissioned an independent qualitative research study with a sample of mass market Canadian investors aged 25 plus who are in an advised relationship with portfolios of $100,000 or less, comprised mostly of mutual funds. And the purpose of our study was to understand the potential impact on this mass market investors currently in advised relationships.
Thank you. Does anyone want to add anything, or we'll move on to our next question? Dwayne?
I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind just addressing that briefly. I think it makes sense to talk about service level agreements independent of how advisors are compensated, because it shouldn't matter. The idea that you would put on paper in plain English, rather briefly, and reviewed with a client what you're proposing to provide to them as a service in return for your compensation doesn't seem like anything to be debated to me.
Thank you. So
I'll leave it at that.
Dwayne, did you want to add anything?
Well, I mean, I think the other panelists have said it pretty succinctly, but I mean, I think anything that leads to the streamlining of the account opening process lays out a list of services, regardless of what you want to call it, whether it's a service level agreement or, you know, for lack of a better term, just a list of services, as Dan just mentioned, I think should be pretty standard within the relationship between an advisor and their client to understand and then ultimately be able to make the decision as to whether they see value in those services provided and then how they want to pay for those services.
Sandra?
We already have a relationship disclosure information form. It's really boring. It's really dry. If we're going to go this route, then I would recommend looking at, as the regulators are, not everything, but let's look at what we already have out there that does address relationship and make it better. So if you're going to include a list of services in particular, whether fees are attached or not, let's add it to something that's already there that talks about the relationship between the advisor and the client.
So improve existing forms before adding more forms.
Yes.
Okay. Can I just add one last thing?
Sure.
If you believe in this type of disclosure and if you think it has value, then it should adhere to certain criteria like plain language, no generic or boilerplate language. It should be in conjunction with a mandated discussion around fees so that the focus is about fees. And I think the industry has a role to play in providing standard templates and forms in plain language without boilerplate that IFIC has done for the CRM2 implementation. So I think there is a role to play for industry associations to foster better transparency and better understanding.
So we'll move to our second question, and that focuses on direct pay options alongside embedded commissions. To provide investors with choice and flexibility in how they would like to pay for advice, another option consistently put forward by industry stakeholders is to require dealers to offer their clients a direct pay arrangement alongside an embedded commission option. Should the CSA require dealers to offer direct pay option in addition to the current embedded commission payment model? What type of direct pay arrangements would likely be offered? For example, would the alternative simply be a fee-based account, or would dealers offer a range of alternatives? Also, how can we ensure that investors will be better off under this model and actually be offered a direct pay option that would be truly competitive with the embedded commission option, i.e. that investors would not be skewed or incentivized to provide to favor the embedded commission option if it is not in their best interest? Sandra, could you start the discussion?
Oh, sure. Well, as everybody knows, direct pay today lives alongside the embedded commission option, and it works well. And we're in favor of that continuing. With a direct pay approach only, though, investors may forego, and our advice shows this, paying for advice and choose investing alternatives that may not support good long-term investing behavior. Some dealers aren't set up for it internally, so this is their business structure, and some are considering moving in that direction as they see business reasons to, the ability to sell ETFs, for example, the ability to sell F-class shares, or to provide their advisors with the ability to run a fee-for-service business alongside embedded commissions. It's an evolution, though, and it takes time, and it's not for everyone, every dealer, advisor, or client. And we don't believe that the CSA should require a dealer to change its business model. Our research showed that investors preferred choice in how they pay for their investments. Having the choice between indirect and direct payment options increased the feeling of control. And a research participant said, "I think it should be up to me to decide whether or not I pay indirectly or directly." That said, 77% of participants want the option to continue to pay indirectly. And this supports John Adams' comment on the front end versus the DSC option. You asked within the question, how do you ensure the client understands which option is best for them? I'll give you an example of my own situation. I went to my advisor, and he said it was time to look at my accounts and how the fees were being paid. I have 5 accounts. We looked at each account and the activity in the account, and we determined on a case-by-case basis, comparing if we go fee-based or embedded commission, which one was best for each account. I understood the comparison. I understood the recommendation for a change because it was to my benefit, and we moved forward. That seems to me very common sense, and I don't think overly onerous.
Dan?
Yeah, I'd like to maybe start by clarifying what direct pay would likely mean. Or what it does mean today. There's been a lot of reference to paying up front, writing a check. And unless you're in a fee-for-service financial planning arrangement with no products sold at all, no products bought, that doesn't happen. A client has an account. The fees are set out ahead of time. And the investment account is debited from the cash for the amount of the fees every month, every quarter, whatever the arrangement is. And with that understanding, I would ask those that are vehemently against eliminating commissions, what's the difference between getting a 1% trailing commission from a revenue standpoint and a fee debited from the account, not written with a check, that is charged at the same level of a 1% fee? if the revenue level is the same, what is the burden on the industry in that comparison?
You're talking about the sale of a product. What about provision of financial planning advice that's over and above the product fee?
That can work the same way. If the 1% trailing commission isn't enough to compensate for the planning, a separate fee is charged. Same thing here. If you're charging 1% explicitly, debited from the account, and that's not enough to pay for the financial planning, then you charge additional fees. You present that to the client before the services are engaged.
And the client pays it directly out of his pocket.
For financial planning, that would be the case in both scenarios. But that's independent of whether we maintain commissions or not.
Dwayne?
You know, I looked at the question perhaps a little differently in that, you know, to me I read it as the premise here is that embedded is more expensive than a fee-based model. And I don't necessarily think that's going to be true in all cases, that, you know, embedded compensation is going to be more expensive. But I think it really goes down to the underlying case, and I think everyone's making the same comments and have made the same comments through the other two sessions, is that it really does come down to choice. You know, as an independent asset manager, you heard Barry before me in the previous session, and then you heard Rob in the very first session. You know, Franklin Templeton, we're an independent asset manager. We are manufacturing our investment capabilities and offering them in a number of different vehicles, from low-cost ETFs through the whole range of the investor cohort life cycle, so to speak. And, you know, we operate in a retail business, an institutional business, and a high-net-worth business. So to us, it should be about choice and how Canadians access financial advice. Obviously, we advocate the value of advice. I don't think any of us would be here if we didn't believe in that. But quite frankly, it should really come down to choice in how an investor wants to pay for that advice, and then what is the right vehicle that they can use to then ultimately lead to their future financial security. And so I think options are great, but I don't necessarily think that, you know, just, and I know the focus is around the banning of embedded compensation, but I don't want to necessarily put it out there that's saying it is this bad, all-encompassing, higher cost structure no matter what. But there are multiple ways, I think, that we can go at how do you get value from that advice.
So just to add my two cents, of course, we have the two models side by side today, and some firms offer both platforms, and some offer them through different affiliates, and some offer one or the other. So you have the products and services available in the marketplace today. But you know, Dan asked a good question, and the answer is, of course, the industry can provide both for a cost. It's being done, and it would continue to be done. And if one was banned, then the industry would go with the other. But I think perhaps the impact on the account might be different. So while the cost might be the same, the impact on the account might be different. When you shift the cost of calculating fees from the fund company to the individual dealer, you have a sort of a different cost model. And anybody who has to calculate fees, as you do when you do a fee-based account, has to do a couple of things that were once done by someone else. You have to the cost of calculating the fee, you need a fee engine to calculate fees. Calculate fee frequency, you have to calculate taxes, you have to aggregate or exclude various accounts. You've got to do all that at the dealer level, and there's a cost to that. You have to administer the fees, you have to administer the fee agreements, and then, as Dan says, if you're taking the fee out of the account, you have to clear the quarterly debits, and then you have trading costs and printing, mailing confirms. So there are costs to doing a fee-based account, And that cost, while it's incremental, and it's not probably impossible by any means, but it would impact smaller accounts far more than a large account. And it would impact a smaller account in a way different than an embedded commission. And it gets back to this whole argument about, you know, would people be willing to pay that cost? Would advice be less available?
I'd like to add just two more quick things. I think those are valid points, Paul, around the cost. But every fund company I've spoken to, and I think Barry said it earlier, is that the fastest growing part of the sales is on the F-Series. So clearly dealers are getting on board with the fee-based platform. And on the issue of choice, I don't know how real the choice is. Sandra, I think your experience, based on my experience, just from everything I've seen and heard, is unusual, that it would be laid out that clearly. Usually, and I think this is not a big surprise, clients would look to their advisor to say, well, what do you think is best? So is there really a menu of choices being presented and clearly lining up, here's how the impact, here's what it's going to cost you with each scenario? That's certainly not what I'm seeing throughout the rest of the industry. So, you know, there's actually a lot of research that says too much choice is actually a bad thing. There's been books written about this. But I don't know that there, even where different options are available, an advisor or a firm is going to really promote the option that either suits a particular client or suits their business model if they're catering to a specific type of client. I don't see firms putting a bunch of different choices for compensation in front of people.
We'll move on to our third question, which is on disclosure. Many industry stakeholders urge the CSA not to discontinue embedded commissions, but instead to focus on enhancements to disclosure to improve investors' understanding of the impact of fund fees and dealer compensation on their long-term investment outcomes, as well as to improve their ability to assess the reasonableness of the fees relative to other investment options. While enhancements to disclosure may be helpful in certain circumstances, in CSA CP 81408, the CSA did not believe that disclosure alone could mitigate all of the issues. For example, the CSA points to research that has shown that disclosure of a conflict of interest can have unintended perverse effects, such as clients being more likely to follow the conflicted advice. The CSA also found that investors' high level of trust and reliance on their advisors for investment decisions may cause them to not thoroughly review disclosure documents and reports, and thus limits the benefits to be derived from disclosure. Other research also shows that clients do not read disclosure, irrespective of whether they are advised or not. Given some of these shortcomings, please explain your views as to how, if at all, disclosure can be enhanced to help better inform investors and improve both investor and dealer representative behavior. Let's start with Duane.
Well, I'm certainly not going to sit here and say that we need more disclosure. So I don't think the answer is more disclosure. I truly think it's more meaningful disclosure. And I think that's a throwaway comment. I know it's easy for me to make that comment, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we have to figure out how to make that disclosure more meaningful and effective. We've already got point of sale now. We have CRM2. I think these are good first initial steps of moving that forward. And quite frankly, I think we're in such early days still with respect to point of sale and CRM2 that, and I know it was said in an earlier panel, I think we need to give it some time to see how those pieces of regulation take hold, and will they potentially solve some of the concerns we have today, and do we need to continue to add more forms and disclosure at investors, or will this work itself out over time? You know, I'm certainly supportive of the fact that the CSA and the regulators do want to look at the overall regulatory burden, so I think that's meaningful, and I think that's very constructive. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is about client education, and advisors need to be educating the clients around what is the deal that they have with their advisor, and then what is this ultimate disclosure. So, obviously, we support, disclosure to the nth degree in that regard, but I think, we don't necessarily need to just go and add more regulation on top of it, but look for ways of making that disclosure more meaningful so that it is read at the end of the day.
Just to follow up on your question, though, a lot of the comment letters stated that, let's see how CRM2 is working and point of sale is working. Can you give me an estimate on how long you think we need to wait to find out if those are actually working?
Man, wouldn't that be uh, Wouldn't that be good if I had that answer?
Well, you tell us to wait, so you must have an idea how long you want us to wait. Is it another 20 years? Or?
Well, I don't think. I mean, I think there's always the parameter. I doubt there'd be any regulator that'd be willing to wait 20 years. But I think it's incumbent upon us to see if the existing, I mean, these are relatively still very new, very young pieces of regulation. So, you know, giving it time to wait, you know, I'd probably defer to Paul here to see if he's got more of a time frame, but I think longer than the year or two. We're a member of IFIC, so I can kick it over to him like that. So.
I'm not. But, someone's going to give me a number on
this. No, I'm not leaving. No, and it's fair, and I don't think it has to go on indefinitely, but I think we haven't given it enough time to see if it is taking hold and giving us the results we wanted to.
Sandra, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a lot of information out there, hundreds of studies over many, many, many years about how people learn. And we don't all learn the same way. And we don't all learn in the same time frame. I like pictures. Other people like reading. Other people like to be told. Some people need to be told 10 times. Some people like to see a picture 5 times. It's very, very different. And the OSC's own Office of the Investor, I believe it was, issued a behavioral insights report. So you may get a little closer answer from them. But it reviewed how research and experience has shown how most choices are not made with careful deliberation. So essentially, why provide more if it's not going to be deliberated? So I'll go back to what I said earlier. Look at what we have now and what the purpose of it is for and how it's been written, how it's being received, and enhance what we already have. Given the market and its participants, give the market and its participants time to evolve. In time, it will become evident what is working and what is not. CRM2 makes all dealer fees clear, including embedded commissions, but it is recent. Ongoing compliance with CRM2 in point of sale should help with future fee awareness among investors. It is unclear that banning commissions will materially improve awareness and understanding of investment fees. Our research shows that even with direct fees, if investors choose to pay through automatic redemptions or pre-authorized debit, for example, there is unlikely to be an increase in their understanding and awareness of their fees. Out of sight, out of mind.
Paul?
Well, let me, when I discuss disclosure, I'm talking about it in the context of a long tenured relationship between a client and an advisor. That's the sort of framework for disclosure. And investors will advocate the advice they get over the long term, and to the extent that the advice is useful and productive and enriching, then they will continue in the relationship and probably deposit more trust into that relationship. So disclosure in that context can work or not. There is research, just as you say, on the impact of disclosure, some of the perverse impacts, some of the positive impacts. I think we have to look at all that research carefully. It all has limits. None of it answers the question, but I think it's important to consider it all. To your question about how long we should wait, I mean, there is research going on now. The CSA has a project to assess some of the impacts of CRM2 and fun facts, and I know that the first tranche of that research is to be delivered, I think, sometime in 2021. But there are other commissions are doing research as well as IFIC, which is a little more current, or at least the timing is a little more current. We know the ASC has done some research on this. We know the BCSE is doing research of their own, and they've released some of it. Here's an early finding. Awareness of direct fees has risen from 67% to 76%, and awareness of indirect fees has risen from 48% to 59%. So that's research based on CRM2, and none of it's conclusive, but I think it's, it shows that things seem to be moving in the right direction, at least for now. IFIC included in its annual Polaris survey of investor sentiment some questions on CRM2, and how it's working and whether it's working, and are people reading their statements, and if they're reading them, what are they getting out of them? So we'll be publishing that fairly shortly as well. So I don't think we have to wait forever, and I think we should look at some of the research that we're doing that suggests that disclosure can work. And I know that the regulators, I know the CSA believes that disclosure works. It's in the principles of the Ontario Securities Act. It says it's one of the key tools that that the Ontario government and the OSC are going to use is just timely, accurate, and efficient disclosure. So that's obviously the legislation makes that a primary objective. There are 23 national instruments just dealing with investor-targeted disclosure. So clearly we believe in it. It can work. And I think, but it's just another regulatory tool amongst all the other rulemaking, disclosure, enforcement, compliance, proficiency. They're all tools. But I think disclosure can work if it's framed in the right way, and I think it is probably less impactful or at least has fewer unintended consequences than some of the other proposals that have been made.
Dan?
So I was involved in a project some years ago in creating an online tool, portfolio analysis tool, that for an entire fund portfolio provided people with a percentage, average percentage fee and dollar fee, provided them with some performance information and a correlation matrix. That was in 1997. So I do feel like in some ways we've been waiting 20 years to get to this point. And of course it's been 22 years since Gloriane Stromberg first wrote, published her first report. So it does feel like this stuff takes a long time. And I think some of that has to do with the perspective that you come from. I'll just speak to my own. It's always been around trying to do what is right for the client and how I would want to be treated if I was sitting on the other end of the table. And I think sometimes that perspective gets lost, sometimes because the investor doesn't have often a voice in the various processes. But I think, Duane, you touched on it. We don't need more disclosure. I've sat in lots of client account opening meetings, and the stack of documents can get fairly high. So just adding a few more pages in there is not going to help. I think disclosure can be effective. Again, I'll speak to my experience. I'm not aware of any research that addresses these issues. When it's truly written in plain English, when it's accompanied by a simple explanation, verbal, when it's in writing, so it can be referred to later, and when that is paired with meaningful periodic reporting, so that when the fees come off the account, the quarterly report shows, well, here are the fees you paid last quarter, year to date, and over the past year. So it's not out of sight, out of mind. You really have to look at that as a whole. It's part of an entire reporting regime for clients. I'm proud to say that we've created that at our firm. I'm not here to promote the firm. These issues have zero impact on our business. I'm here just out of personal interest, frankly. A glutton for punishment, perhaps. But I think that's my view on disclosure. I know there's been lots of research on it. I'm not aware of any. I mean, even I look at Fund Facts, for example. I think it's a good document, but one of the pieces that I think is most important, which is the risk rating summary, I think needs a lot of work. And I won't go into detail here. I think detailed fairly specific recommendations in my submissions in the past, so I won't go over that now. And with CRM2, with the reports that resulted from that, again, I think an excellent step. But something along the lines that I did about 20 years ago, I think we need to take the costs and charges disclosure one step further so people can get a total picture, so that firms that have completely unbundled their costs don't look more expensive than the client who's invested in a DSC fund where the DSC commission was outside of the disclosure window. So I think there's some work to be done, but I think we're making some progress.
So our fourth question addresses conflict of interest. Many of the alternatives we discussed mainly focus on addressing investor awareness, as well as ensuring fees paid through embedded commissions align with the services received. They do not appear, however, to directly address the conflict of interest inherent in an embedded commission model. Are there any other changes needed to adequately address the conflict of interest? And how can any of those options, either alone or in combination with one another, sufficiently address the conflict of interest inherent with embedded commissions? And Dan, could you lead us off?
Sure. I guess I go back a little bit to the comment I just made. Just around, if standards are set based on doing what's right for the client, I think this becomes fairly simple. And instead of focusing on why it can't be done and why it's too hard, I think the process should be, the order should be, let's figure out what needs to be done and figure out a way to get it done. I'll just leave it at that, because I think it's fairly simple.
So your comment that doing what's best for the client sounds a lot like a best interest standard, but we're not going there today.
Well, again, some have suggested to me, my point of view is influenced by the firm I'm with and the model we have, and I say it's quite the opposite. Regardless of what was happening in the industry, I made a choice as to how I wanted to deal with clients. And as a result, I made decisions to put myself in a position where not only am I a legal fiduciary as a licensed portfolio manager, but I fully embrace it and we promote that as a firm.
I had to get that in. Paul, next.
Dan brought it up. IFIC's position has been that the client's interests always have to be put first where those interests conflict with the firm's. And so our understanding of the best interest has always been in the context of conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're very focused on conflicts of interest. By virtue of some research we commissioned, but this is just economic theory, there are conflicts built into all principal-agent relationships and all compensation arrangements. And they result from conflicting incentives, which we see writ large in the embedded commission, and the information asymmetry, which is inevitable when you're dealing with an expert. And what further complicates our particular issue here is the uncertain and future nature of financial advice. It makes it very difficult to assess whether it's valuable or not, and you won't know for perhaps many years. So, there's a real reluctance to pay immediately for something that you're not sure you're going to get, and you're certainly not going to get it today. You're going to get it sometime later. So those are the sorts of things that create a conflict, and we've proposed a number of initiatives, 8 altogether. Some of them deal directly with conflicts of interest, so capping and standardizing trailer fees would deal directly with the incentive, the differential incentive, which may incent bad behavior. So we've focused on some of them, deal with conflicts of interest, not selling mutual funds which have an advice fee attached to it through the discount brokerage channel. That's a narrow slice of the conflict issue, but it's there. So there are things that we proposed. We also proposed some things that deal with awareness of fees and getting value for money, the other issues. But we don't think that banning embedded commissions will eliminate compensation-based conflicts of interest, and we know there are many. The CSA did a review in late winter last year, and there was 27 compensation arrangements examined. 18 of them had conflicts in them. So I think that understanding that we're not going to eliminate conflicts of interest, are there things that can be done that would mitigate or mute the impact of the conflict, and yet allow investors to have choice.
Dwayne?
I mean, I think all the panelists summed it up. I mean, I might throw in a bit of a different wrench. I mean, I do agree that, you know, we do largely now have, you know, embedded compensation is largely standardized today. So as far as I'm concerned, the conflict is more mitigated. But we could focus perhaps on other aspects of the overall relationship and probably bring in, you know, a little bit more scrutiny around 81-105 and enforcing sales practices, which probably isn't something everybody wants to hear or say, let's really dig into that. But I think it's inherent in all of us to look at all aspects of the relationship and look at various aspects of it to make sure that we're trying to remove as much potential conflict as possible.
Thank you. And Sandra?
Well, I think identifying and resolving conflict of interest situations is crucial, but conflicts are not necessarily a failing. They're a description of a set of circumstances. And in, again, going back to our research, we found weak indicators of investor concern about conflicts of interest. Among the research participants, some investors were concerned about a conflict of interest. Some felt it was a reasonable way for an investor to be paid, while some were comfortable with indirect fees but wanted more transparency. One participant said, "I feel okay about it. They have to get paid some way." There was no strong conclusion, though, that this was a problem overall.
Okay. So for our final question, and it's been already been asked, but the new panel, so maybe we'll get a different point of view on this. So when research reveals that what retail investors value most in an advisor is trust and transparency, then how can embedded or hidden compensation ever be justified?
Well, I mean, I think it's been alluded to in the by their panels, but while it's embedded, it's not hidden. It's disclosed, fully disclosed. thank you, David. It's fully disclosed both in the annual cost report and in the fund facts. And so they get the percentage of the investment is disclosed in terms of the trailer fee, as well as the trailer fee in dollars and cents. So, you know, as I said at one time, if the industry's been trying to hide it, they've been doing a terrible job because it's fully disclosed, it's available, and investors can consider whether or not they're getting value for their money.
I don't know whether I could say it any better, Paul.
Dan?
Well, I think on a product-by-product perspective, the information is there, and I think that's improved with fund facts because it's easier to find. But again, if I, as I've done over the years and we do today, have put ourselves in the position of clients, we say, well, isn't this most meaningful to provide to them on a total portfolio basis? Because in most cases, advisors are not recommending a single product for an entire portfolio across all accounts. So we're doing portfolio analysis anyway to lead up to the recommendation to the client. So that is just one piece of information we already provide and have for years, which is here is what the cost is going to be. So even before they have committed, again, this is something that was one of the purposes of that tool that I helped create 20 years ago. So I think that is something that should be done. It does fall on the dealers, and I know they're the lower margin component of the food chain, but they are the client-facing firms, as we are. And we've taken on that obligation as well, so I'm at least taking my own recommendations.
Final word to Sandra.
I agree with Paul, and we don't expect that the outcome of banning embedded commissions, not hidden commissions, would materially address the three concerns in the CSA's paper.
Thank you. So now we'll take questions, and I'll turn the floor over to John.
Do we have any questions?
There's one there.
The questions we received in advance have already been covered in the discussion. This one came directed for Sandra and Paul. A shift to a fee-based system would involve 12,000 to 36,000 added transactions per year for many advisor practices. I guess the calculating of the fee on a quarterly basis over the number of accounts. An embedded model sees no transactions, only fund dealer payments 12 times per year. Which model is most economical and which fosters better client behavioral outcomes?
Beats the hell out of me. Paul?
I think the question answered itself.
Got an ops person in the room here?
Is there a concern over the fact that a ban on embedded commissions may result in an increased cost to investors? Trailing commissions are typically 1%, while fees paid by investors in F-class are typically north of 1.5%. Is that your experience?
I mean, the starting fee, 1% is very common, sometimes with a dollar minimum, sometimes 1.5%. I've never seen it higher than about 1.4, 1.5. And I think to the issue of will costs rise in that environment, I think it's an issue of it'll rise for some and it'll fall for others. But overall, I don't think that we will see an overall increase in costs. But I think when you have that greater transparency, you've got greater accountability, and that puts the client in a better position to at least start negotiating.
Our research, by the way, showed that clients were not inclined to negotiate.
Well, I don't know how knowledgeable they were about exactly.
Well, we're talking 25 years and older, under 100,000 in investable assets.
This is a question that perhaps is directly at the OSC, Maureen. At the end of the day, what does success look like out of today's discussion?
Okay. Next question.
So I'd just like to thank this panel for their thoughtful and candid responses and the discussion, and I'll pass the podium back to John. Thank you.